This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore, and the band is back together again. It is nice to have people like Tony and Nick to join us when our schedules get a bit crazy, which they have been this month, haven't they, Ken?
Man, it has been insane. And you know, listen, Zach and I, we're committed to a new show every single week, right? So, and we haven't missed. And we both hit some crazy work schedules, but we have great support and people ready to step up and keep these episodes coming.
Yeah, we've had a lot of success lately with March, now the biggest rated month of all time for Standard Orbit and downloads, which is great for us. I mean, it's like, hey, we're doing something right, Ken? And a big win with a Red Shirt Starship, which is now the highest downloaded podcast in Standard Orbit history. So now we work on another episode that we hope will surpass that show. This week, right. we laugh, but we're serious at the same time. This week is all about those cuddly, adorable, slimy, scaly, secreting, suction-cupping monsters of the original series. The creatures of the original series, iconic in every way, and we thought it'd be a fun topic to talk about.
It's an interesting subject, really. You know, you think about it, Monsters of Trek. Monsters of Trek sounds like monster truck ads that you...
Sunday.
Yeah, that's right, man. And it's Star Trek, monsters. And, you know, they've had some pretty cool ones. A lot of things that have become iconic and fun and things that we can laugh at because, hey, you know, we love the original series. We love the reboots. We also like to have a little fun at their expense from time to time because... hey, you know, it was the stories. Some of those budgets didn't work out so well. Some of them did, however, and especially in some of the things that they've done in newer episodes like Enterprise, where we look at some of our favorite critters and creatures from the Star Trek, the original series, how they've been able to use computer effects to make them look, I guess, a little bit more genuine. But yeah, this is going to be fun. This was a great subject, Zach, and I'm looking forward to getting down that list.
Well, to start off, the Mantrap, right? First episode broadcast, first creature of Star Trek. Now, do you call it the Salt Vampire or the M113 creature, Ken?
I've always said Salt Vampire. So that's what I knew it as. I always thought this was a pretty original looking creature, wasn't it? I mean, it was pretty frightening if you were a little kid, probably back in that day. Now, when you first started seeing Star Trek, you were fairly young. Did the Salt Vampire get you at all, or was it just too silly for, you know, a mature audience, or what?
I found it very effective. I mean, I equate it to, I mean, I was terrified of the Gremlin from William Shatner's, one of William Shatner's Twilight Zone episodes, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. And you look at it now, yeah, and you're like, yeah, it's like a guy in a rubber mask and a little fuzzy suit. But when you're a kid, that is the stuff of nightmares, you know? And I'll say the same thing about the vampire here. It's a very ugly creature, but it's also a very sad creature. So, like, it's an expressionless mask, but it has expression to it, you know? And we don't see it for very long either. And I think that's also a very... effective trope of the episode where they save it for the big reveal at the end, and you see it and you don't really dwell on it because this, you know, action's happening. Kirk's, you know, getting the salt sucked out of him, you know, Spock and McCoy are arguing. So it's one piece of the climax of the episode. It's not like a big, like, look at this thing the whole time. It's used sparingly, but very effectively.
I agree with you. It has that, You're right. It did have an expression, didn't it? And it did look sad. And you could be almost empathetic if it wasn't so, I don't know, mean, so thirsty, so hungry, whatever it was for Salt. But yeah, it did have a very unique appeal. And it's interesting, too, because it wasn't one of those monsters that came back, right? It was, I know it was the last of its kind, too, so that had, but sometimes you'll see things like, oh, I don't know, like Nomad, you know, he'll come around in a couple of different ways.
You say that, Ken, but we do see the Salt Vampire again in the Squire of Gothos. It's in Trelane's, one of his trophies.
That's right. Yeah. That good catch there. Yeah, that's true. I guess you're right. He was on display, but
she was on display.
She was on display. My goodness, you're all over me. But that's good. Let's be accurate here. We have to know what we're talking about, right? When it comes to
the
these
listeners, will let us know
creatures.
If we don't. That's for sure. But yeah, it was the last of its kind. So it was that added some tragedy to it. You know, watching the episode back through and like imagining that creature at all the places that, the people that it's impersonating are, it's really creepy just to think about that thing just like standing in the turbo lift or, you know.
Oh, I know it, yeah.
Or walking on the bridge or part of the briefing room. So it's interesting. And we talked about this when we did our Mantrap commentary for the 50th anniversary, on the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. I'm not sure what episode that was. Yet again, I've failed to look up our previous episode numbers, Ken. So maybe you can help me out while I'm talking here. But
sure, I can do that as you're talking. Now, just keep talking. It could be another 15 or 20. No, I'm just kidding.
stall. it was interesting because, you know, with the M113 creature, which is what I've always called it, they treat it like a generic sci-fi show would treat a monster of the week, and I think that's why a lot of people don't like the Mantrap, because like, oh, it's killing our people, we have to kill it. And then, you know, we'll talk about the Horta in a little bit here, obviously, and they take the opposite approach with the Horta, like, oh, we need to understand this creature, and oh, okay, well, it was just protecting itself, and okay, well, we're not going to kill it. They take a very different approach, but at the same time, it was a clear and present danger to the crew. It killed like 4 or 5 people in the span of a day. Which makes me question, like, what's this creature's motivations? Because it went, you know, years just surviving on salt tablets, and then it, you know, it immediately killed not a red shirt, but a blue shirt. It was pre-red shirt, you know, first episode and all. And then killed, like, 2 or 3 people after that. It just went on this bloodlust, or salt lust, I should say. And so it's like, okay, a little bit of self-control and everything would have been fine. But, you know, had to overstep its bounds.
Yeah, but that's actually a very human characteristic, right? So, well, first of all, it's episode 137 tonight on NBC, and we did air it on September 8th, as we should have, right? And it came out perfectly, 50 years to the day. But now, Zach, when you think about it, there's people out there all the time. They go on these crazy diets. Your body adapts to the environment that you're in. But once you get a taste, you know, it's like alcohol or a certain kind of food. I mean, if you're all of a sudden, you know, how many people out there can eat just one potato chip, right? I mean, this is one of those things. If you just have a little, and then all of a sudden it's a smorgasbord, right? And it's all there in front of you. I think the resistance is minimal, right? In the case of this monster, it had to keep the professor alive, had to be, in order to at least just get some from time to time, if it needed some, if there were no salt tablets. But then when these people show up, it's like, oh, it's like ringing the dinner bell. And so to me, that made a lot of sense. It intellectually, you say, yes, it should have been able to figure it out, not be so obvious or whatever, but it just completely lost control.
But it needs love just as much as it needs salt, right, Ken?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I thought that was all in his head, to be honest with you. That was completely contrived. But I will say that it was not an episode that began the journey of the understanding of what Star Trek was, is, and what it was meant to be. It was one. It was a Lost in Space episode, although it was done a little bit with a little bit of intelligence. I mean, it was a clever monster. It was the last of its kind, so there was some empathy for it. But it still didn't stop them from, you know, killing it and beating it, or finding a way to come up with a way to sustain it. You know, I mean, I think if you were to take that episode, and I know we did this the other way, let's say it's a TNG episode, right? They probably would have found a way to put it into some kind of stasis and found a way to be able to feed it so it could live on its own back down on that planet. That, you know, just because times have evolved. And the show evolved very quickly after that. But it was a, you know, it was the monster of the week, try to get the big ratings, scary, ooh, you know, here's a creature for you to kick off the show. You understand their intent, but it's an okay episode. It's not one of the better ones, but a very, very good creature, very great design, I thought. And, you know, they did what they could with it. And, you know, it was a Dr. McCoy episode, so that's not a bad thing.
Well, that's the salt vampire. The next monster that I could find, Kim, was the White Rabbit from Shore Leave. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, we saw in Monty Python that rabbits can be deadly. And what's it going to do? Nibble your bum, right? Yeah, anyway, I'm sorry. I digress. Yeah, okay. Next.
Well, the next one would be and I'm not sure what to call these guys. But they're the guys from the Galileo 7.
Yeah, I was very happy that they went on to make Geico commercials many years later.
So the we're going to call them cavemen, apparently. So
I guess so. That's what they reminded me of. I guess were they monsters or were they just...
Well, the planet is called Taurus 2, so right. We could call them the Taurusians. But they were, you know, they were basically like giant Neanderthal creatures, you know, ape men almost, really. Like, and we don't really see them straight on, which is probably a wise idea, because you know they didn't. The scale was a little off in this episode, I think, with these creatures. I guess they might be from different sizes, but sometimes they're like, it looks like he's just standing up straight and he's taller than the shuttlecraft, like banging a giant rock on it. But other times, like when he's cornering that one blue shirt, I believe, and it's like you just see the back of the creature before it cuts to the commercial. The guy's like, you know, it's like that guy's like, that's like 6 feet tall. So I'm not sure what the scale is, but I understand we're nitpicking, but hey, that's what we do, right? We're Star Trek fans, so
we are.
Again, as a child, I was scared of these creatures, you know, because you hear all these noises and these giant spears, and it's a very atmospheric environment they created on that planet set. And again, wisely knowing the limitations of, you know, what they have as far as creatures and makeup and whatnot, much like the salt vampire. They're like, we're just going to show you just enough to get the point across, but I'm not going to like have a close up. But like, oh, here's the big monster with the rock, right? If the TV show was on today, you'd have like a really questionable CGI monster attacking the shuttle. When instead it's a tangible, you know, it's like a stuntman with the, you know, some makeup and a bit of a costume on, and it gets the point across. So again, I thought that the threat factor was real. I didn't like laugh at it or anything. Again, watching this as a child, it has that nostalgic factor for me, where I'm like, yeah, I remember when I was scared of this. Now if I watch it today for the first time, I'd be like, oh, all right, well, you know, for the 60s that was fine. So
yeah, you know what got me watching that episode was there, it took a while to reveal too, and you heard the growls, and it was kind of scary. You know, back when I remember first watching it, and you know, the spears, even the size of those things were huge, and the one shot where the guy gets it, I was like, man, that would have just plowed right through him. But it was well done for its time. And when I watch it now remastered, that episode, especially with the shuttle at the end, it was really, really cool. You know, when they burn the fuel, it really just has a whole new look to it. They didn't do anything with the creatures, because they couldn't. But I thought that that episode was scary. I thought they were a good. I can't really call them villains, right? Because they're just protecting their home world, or they really don't understand what's going on. Plus, apparently quite a few of them got phasered, though we didn't see it,
right?
And I don't know if it had any effect or not, but the thing was shooting versus normal. Most of the time when the phasers don't work, they just actually do not work. So, you know, it's one of those things too, where you say, hey, yeah, maybe bullets would be more effective than those things. But anyway, we move on. But I thought they were pretty cool. It was a good episode. It was scary. And it was one of those really good, I thought, Spock McCoy type, you know, you really started to see the lines drawn between their two personalities.
Right. Well, you needed these creatures to add another sense of danger, because if they were just stranded there, the stress level would not have continued to escalate, and that's what led to these great character moments between Spock and McCoy and the rest of the shuttle crew there. Because I mean, we got to leave the Enterprise is going to leave. We're getting attacked. You know, it's just like all those things combined created a perfect combination of a stressful situation that Spock had to rise to the occasion for his first command.
Yeah, yeah. The only problem I remember really seriously with the episode was when the folks did get killed and they were, McCoy kept pushing for them to have a service and bury the body. I just would have said, it's cremation time and we'll do a service when we get back to the ship.
Well, can't you just, I mean, if you're really going to cremate them, couldn't you just use your phaser and cremate them right there?
That's where I was
going. You know?
Yep, I mean, that's exactly what I mean. Just, you know.
He deserves a burial. Know. It's like, come on, guys, this is not the time of the play. We can come back later. I mean, like, that's not the time. You know,
It's amazing to me that when we watch these old episodes and we think about ourselves as human beings, but it's so clear that Spock is right and you're seeing things through his eyes and you're going, how come they're not more rational?
Right.
You know, anyway.
You guys are being completely logical right now. It's frustrating.
Did we do a tangent? I think we did.
I think
sorry.
You know, I did want to say I appreciate you guys keeping up the standard orbit tangents, even though I wasn't there.
You know, I just like the fact that Nick just said that, yeah. You know, many times. Oh, standard order 10, and then off he'd go. And
trademark.
Yeah. Absolutely.
If we ever do t-shirts, absolutely. Ken, for our run on standard orbit here, we need to come up with some cool design. We'll talk to Aaron Harvey. We've got a cool standard orbit tangent.
Oh, that's right. Working. Yeah. We'll stay within the confines a little bit of the subject, but off we go. Yeah. And for some of our other podcasters, you know, who have seen how we do the show and how things are scripted, you would think that we would have everything buttoned up line by line. We know exactly what we're going to do, what we're going to say. Boy, oh boy, when we say those are guidelines, we are not kidding.
Guidelines, much like the CBS fan film guidelines, Ken.
So you went there.
Too
you
soon.
Went there. Okay.
Moving on to Arena. This is a great episode. It's been called the Citizen Kane of Star Trek by some of our predecessors here on Standard Orbit, and I would agree. It's a great episode. But it's iconic for one reason, and that reason is the Gorn, right? From even the first shot of him, he turns around, he's like, rawr, rawr, and the sounds that he makes, too. But Ted Cassidy, who knew? Ruck from What Are Girls Made Of, the voice of Baylock. Ted Cassidy, man, doing the voice of the Gorn. And so what are your thoughts on the Gorn? Like, does it hold up to you? Because I know earlier you mentioned when Enterprise updated the creatures, you liked that. So what are your thoughts?
It doesn't hold up as far as, I mean, the episode itself holds up for what it represents. It represents Star Trek, I think, as its finest, right? Who's really the villain here? And, of course, you know, the Gorn, they're not the nicest, but, you know, did they have a right to do what they did? And I think that's the whole crux of it. But does the Gorn hold up? No, but it's so Star Trek. I mean, it's just, it's everything you think about when you watch that show. And you just laugh, right? I mean, you can't help it, but you enjoy it. Because, you know, have you ever seen a punch thrown as slow as a Gorn's punch?
Or he's you know, a cold-blooded reptile, Ken.
Well, yeah, but, you know, even an alligator can run up to 30 miles an hour, you know, for a short distance. I mean, it's not like they just don't come out of the water. You know, you ever see, you know, a saltwater croc? Those things aren't exactly, you know, in slow motion. So, at any rate, you're right. It's a cold-blooded creature. I get it. And it worked fine. You know, the best part of the episode was the building of the gunpowder and all that stuff. It was very, very clever. Very clever. And the Gorn was not as clever, but I love watching the show because it's Star Trek, man. It's just Arena is what Star Trek's all about. And every time I watch it, I'm saying, this is awesome. And I'm laughing at the Gorn, you know, but the beginning of the episode, the way it ends, I mean, it's bookended beautifully and it's very, you know, you have what? 30 years later, you have William Shatner and the Gorn playing the video game. You know, if you haven't seen it, you got to look it up on YouTube. It's absolutely hilarious. You know, they're throwing pillows at each other.
Yeah, for the Star Trek video game that came out around the time of Into Darkness, there was a tie-in commercial with William Shatner and someone in a Gorn costume, and it looked just like the original Gorn costume. That's why I loved it, right? They didn't try to update it. It was like, there it is, straight from 1960s.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, when they redid it in Enterprise, the characteristics changed a little too much for me, but it was, you know, It was a nasty creature, and that thing could move. That one could actually get around the ship pretty quickly.
I do not like the updated Gorn in Enterprise. They just made him like a dinosaur, you know? And that's fine and all, I guess, but that's not the Gorn. Like, the Gorn has a very distinctive look to it, right? It has the insectoid eyes on a reptilian creature. Like, that's a brilliant like combination of different animal attributes that make it a unique alien. So, like, when they took that away, it wasn't quite the same. And, you know, I get it. I don't know. Again, seeing this as a kid, you know, I just took it as face value. Oh, well, that's a Gorn. Okay. I took it as face value, right?
Right. And I can't, I mean, obviously I remember what the creature was wearing, you know, the Fred Flintstone outfit there, right. But I don't really
shade left and right at the Gorn.
but I don't remember in Enterprise what it was wearing. I don't know if it was some kind of a uniform, if it was something similar, but yeah, I mean, hey, you know, that's what I mean. You got to love the Gorn. That was Star Trek. That was, I don't know. You know, you think of Spock, you think of all these things. But when you think of specific episodes or you think about a monster, you don't think about the salt vampire, right? You think about the Gorn. He was great. He was awesome. Gotta love it. Vasquez rocks, man. Vasquez rocks.
Well, I'm noticing a trend here when we talk about these creatures and monsters. And, you know, it's just smart television production for the 60s, but... again, the Gorn, you mentioned in the beginning of the episode, you know, the landing party beams down to Cessus III. They immediately get in this this battle with an unseen adversary, and it's the Gorn. And again, like we were talking about mentally rewatching the episode, knowing what the M113 creature looks like and putting it in the spots that you would have seen it had it not been camouflaged. If you look back at the beginning of the episode, it is kind of hard to imagine these Gorn running around firing, you know, plasma grenades or whatever they were doing at the landing party with these kind of, you know, slow lumbering creatures.
Well, hey, they were able to manipulate the communications. They thought the Enterprise thought they were talking to the space station, right? And it turned out the whole thing was just completely manipulated by the Gorn. So They were pretty clever. They had a way about them, and you know, so they could easily be underestimated. And so I guess when you finally see the Gorn after you just witnessed all the trickery and, you know, the ambush that they put on that landing party, it was, you know, maybe the two didn't really align as much as you thought. But hey, the Gorn is not to be messed with or ridiculed.
They should have had Ted Cassidy do the voice of the Commodore or whoever at the beginning of the episode, like, ooh, beam on down. You know, that
oh yeah, that yeah, slurping and slurping, yeah, the obvious. Whole way through.
I've
yeah.
heard every word you have said. Now, I always took that as the translator, you know, like that's the translator translating what the Gorn says. Like, the Gorns, like, if they sit around and talk to each other on their ship, they sound like, you know, the lizard sounds, right? They're not sounding like we heard him sound. Is that what you took from it too, Ken?
I did. Yeah, I figured that's what it was. I mean, I thought at first, like everybody else, it was some kind of a recording device and you could take verbal notes with or something, but obviously that wasn't the case. And as it went on, and then when he finally did speak, I was like, no, that's definitely a translator. Because he never speaks to Kirk without it.
Right, exactly.
Because the other time he's just breathing and slurping and doing all that lizardy noise that lizards do.
Do you have a natural revulsion to reptiles, Ken?
You know what? I do. I am. I'm not afraid of them per se. I just don't like them. I don't know what it is. It's a strange thing when it comes to alligators and crocodiles. When I'm down in Florida, or even when I was in Australia, and you see these bad boys. And I remember in Thailand once, I was going down a river, you know, like a little tour river, and there was a crocodile caught in a net, and this thing. You know, it was a Tyrannosaurus Rex. The thing was huge. And you just realize, you know, you don't have a shot if, you know, when it comes to these things. So they are very, very intimidating creatures to me. And, you know, the Gorn was probably a little less intimidating than some of the saltwater crocs I've seen. But I'll tell you, yeah, I guess they're a little spooky. They're a little scary.
You know, I'm more afraid of, like, flying roaches than I am of crocodiles. I probably shouldn't be, but I find insects disgusting.
Yeah, well, I'd like to see what happens when you swat one or the other. You know.
Exactly. Well, crocodiles can't fly in your mouth if you're not careful, so.
No, but you can fly in theirs.
I see what you did there.
Yeah.
So moving on to our next monster of Star Trek would be the Horta from The Devil in the Dark. Obviously, this episode, the Horta is killing miners. It's a mystery. Again, they're concealing the creature. It's always a big reveal when you see these creatures. And, you know, I remember this is Devil in the Dark is probably the first episode of Star Trek I remember watching. It's because I've watched Star Trek my entire life, so it's hard to think about, like, what was the first episode I saw? But this is the first one I remember seeing. I remember, like, going to Space Center Houston that day with, like, my parents, and we came home and watched Star Trek. And that's, like, my first definitive memory of watching Star Trek. And in my head, I was thinking, like, oh, it's Devil in the Dark. I envisioned, like, some kind of, like, gargoyle creature going around killing these guys, right? And then you see it, and you're like, what is that? So it looks kind of like a pizza, right? That's what I always equated it to.
Pizza the Hut?
Pizza the Hut.
Yeah, it does, I guess. I remember first of all, another great episode, right? Vintage Star Trek. And it is funny that these creatures get pulled into it and become such a strong part of it. But I remember that scene before they really displayed what it looked like. It almost seemed like it stood up, right, as it was approaching.
Yeah, it, like, reared up
miners.
And, like, squashed the guy. Yeah.
Yeah, that so, you know, when they showed it for real, you were like, huh, you know, how did it do what it did? But it was brilliant in terms of, I guess, of how they did it. And you know, I think it was probably the first real alien monster, right? Because it didn't have arms and legs.
Yeah, it was a non-humanoid creature. Yeah,
that's right. There wasn't, you know, I know there was somebody, you know, rolling underneath. It probably had one of those little, you know, four wheels or something underneath, you know, like a stunt person would have when they're getting pulled by a car, that type of thing, you know, when you think they're sliding around. But I thought it was really, really well done. And it was believable in the sense that, you know, I had a lot of empathy for the thing. You know what I mean? It wasn't as scary during the big reveal, and you can go, yeah, you know, it looked kind of odd and all of those things. But at the same time, I love the whole idea of what it could do because it was unique. You know, it secretes all this, I guess, acid or whatever, and it just burns through rock, and it sails through it like, you know, a warm knife through butter. And, you know, the whole egg thing, everything about this episode I thought was outstanding. And I thought the scenes with Leonard Nimoy in particular, communicating with it, you know, I remember before I really understood it, thinking it was a little silly and so forth as a little kid, because I was little. But as I've watched it over time, I was like, man, this was pretty good. I they did a nice job with this.
Well, to speak on who played the Horde, it was actually Janos Prochaska, who was a stuntman. He actually went on to play another creature in Star Trek as well. We'll get to that a little later on our list, but he actually designed the Horta costume and performed it himself on the show. So there was a guy under there shuffling around, you know, doing his little Horta shuffle. But yeah, none of these creatures, and we both look back on them with different points of view and laugh at some and are still scared of others, but well, maybe not still scared, but can remember being scared. None of them undermine the episode, right? None of them, like, that's like, you mentioned Lost in Space earlier. Just, it's like a conceptual thing with the man trap. You go look at shows like, you know, Lost in Space or even, and I love the Twilight Zone, but even some Twilight Zone episodes, you're like, yeah, that kind of undercuts what you're going for there, guys. But none of these Star Trek creatures do that. I think the stories are strong enough around them where it's not dependent on the special effects. It's dependent on the story. And that's what Star Trek's strength always is. And it just shows that we can look back at these 50-year-old TV shows with these, you know, goofy looking aliens in some respect, but the story still comes through just as strong as ever.
Oh, it did. It's like I said, it's pure Star Trek. Great creature, great concept, great everything. And it was scary up until the reveal, though. It really was, because you just did not know what this thing was doing and what it could do. And again, Star Trek flips the script on you in the end, right? You know, and it was just a mom protecting its eggs. So
I went on that whole rant just now about how Star Trek special effects hold up and it's great, and, you know, for the next one we're talking about, Operation Annihilate, these parasites are like flying fake vomit, right? I mean, it's just, it's like, really, guys? Like, it's like a misshapen pancake, perhaps a an egg over easy, you know, just flying around on strings, like, in the sounds they make. Like, I don't know. I mean, it's not the best episode either, so that doesn't help. But what are your thoughts on these parasites from they're not from Dineva, but they attack Dineva. So just the parasites from Operation Annihilate.
Well, I think you described it accurately, Zach. You know what? To me, I actually did like this episode because it made me uncomfortable. There was tension in this episode, especially with his nephew. And the idea that, I don't do well with children in jeopardy. I just don't, even if it's a TV show like that. Or the risk of him dying, or the fact that Kirk lost his brother and his sister-in-law also passed, right? I mean, the poor kid.
But it's okay, guys, because Spock got his eyesight back.
Yes, yes.
It's like they end the episode. It's like, okay, this episode more than any other, and we're not here to really talk about the episodes, but it does tie into what we're talking about here. Tangent.
Yeah, but it does. Well, it just shows you the kind of pain, though, that they could create, right? The manipulation that they did. These creatures, they look silly, but they had a powerful venom, a controlling mechanism, right? And so what they could do was scary. I don't know if it rates the word terrifying. And they couldn't pull it off. I mean, you know, it was as phony as, you know, the trying to make flying bats back in the 50s and 60s in the strings and all that stuff. Yeah, it was pretty rough. But, you know, in conceptually, if that episode was to be done today, it probably would play really well. And you could really up the ante with it considerably.
Well, the IDW comics have actually redone Operation Annihilate as a mission for the Kelvin Timeline crew in a comic book. And they tweak the look of the parasites a bit more, and they make it a little bit more alien, a little less... You know, it's animation. I mean, it's drawn. So you can the limits are only that of the imagination as far as that goes. They're not constrained by budgets and practically like how do we make these things work. So that was a far more effective story in that medium than on TV because you just this one the production value does undercut it. But I mean, you're right. They're capable of some terrifying things. It's just you look at it and you're like, yeah, that's a pancake. So.
It's a pancake. Well, yeah, I mean, they kind of look like cells in a way. I don't know. But at any rate, you're right. It wasn't, they couldn't execute on this one as well as they would have liked. And, but like I said, I know you weren't a big fan of the episode. I was, I thought it was pretty good. A lot of tension. So they might not have been scary, but what they could do was very scary.
So the trouble with tribbles, do you count the tribbles in this conversation, Cam? What are your thoughts?
Well, are they monsters to us, Zach, or
the Klingons?
The Klingons, right? So, I guess I wouldn't, but I think it's fun to mention because obviously, to the Klingons, they are terrible monsters, right?
Do they still sing songs of the Great Tribble Hunt? What a great line!
That was the best line, probably. It was fun. That was a great episode.
A mortal enemy of the Empire. Yeah, that is just funny because I guess the thinking there is, and this is an urban legend, I think, but elephants are afraid of mice. I mean, that's the kind of parallel I draw to the Klingons being afraid of tribbles because the Klingons are these big warriors and nothing can scare us, and yet the simplest thing, like a little tribble, can get them all, you know, riled up. And, you know, same thing with an elephant, allegedly, right? I've never seen an elephant and a mouse interact. I don't know where that came from, but you've heard that, right? Like, you know, elephants are afraid of mice.
Well, they played it quite a bit, you know, on Bugs Bunny and
yeah.
stuff. So,
yeah. Cartoons.
So,
cartoons.
So it has to be real. I don't know. But that's a very good analogy, though, when you think about it. And I think that those are the things that make you laugh when you have this tough warrior race that, you know, honor and, you know, they're essentially space ninjas. That go off and you know, sing songs of glorious battles, and there's this little bitty furry purring creature that just, you know, puts them on edge and they can't stand them. So yeah, I think that's I thought that was very cleverly done. It's you know, obviously Star Trek has gotten a lot out of that episode over the years, but yeah, would I consider them a creature in the context of what we're talking about? No, I wouldn't.
And what an easy special effect, right? Like, let's have a ball of fur. That's like the easiest thing ever. That special effect holds up by anyone's standards. But our next creature would be the Mugatu, which is basically, it's like a, well, it's like a horny albino unicorn gorilla, basically. That's the best way I can think of to describe it.
Well, that is definitely the only way it could be described. Horny albino unicorn gorilla. Absolutely. And, you know, Ben Stiller, who was a big Star Trek fan, I remember him hosting, I think it was the 25th anniversary special.
Well, he was a presenter at the 30th anniversary special, yes.
Okay. But I just remember, I didn't know who he was at first, and obviously his fame grew because he was just a stand-up guy way back when and just loved Star Trek. And obviously he named Mugatu shows up again in Zoolander, beautifully, I might add, played by Will Ferrell. And I remember when I saw the movie for the first time, I was actually on deployment and somebody had that DVD. And maybe it was just something that was refreshing, but I remember when I was just laughing my ass off when it came up to the name Mugatu. Nobody knew why except me. And I was like, come on, that's brilliant, right? Spelt a little bit differently. But the Mugatu had to be one of the probably one of the worst creatures ever designed in history.
You don't like it?
I love it for, I mean, it's not, you know.
You're just a hater of Janos Prohaska.
No, Janos, I don't know if you're alive or not, but I don't hate you. But
he played the Mugatu here as well, so.
It's not just a horny albino unicorn gorilla. It's a horny albino unicorn gorilla triceratops or whatever. Or stegosaurus, right?
Because right, yeah.
It's
venom.
It's unbelievable.
Like a rattlesnake.
Not only is it, in theory, a big gorilla that could squeeze you to death, but if it just happens to bite you, you know, it's poisonous. And it's like, well, you know, I would think this thing would be ripping your head off and eating you, not just, oh, a little nibble, and you've got this really, you know. It's like, oh, okay. But yeah, it was unfortunate. But again, iconic Star Trek. I mean, iconic Star Trek. What a great creature. And
it's like the platypus of the Star Trek universe.
It really is. I mean, how many different things could you sew together to come up with this? And that blue face. I mean, come on. It was unbelievable.
I believe it had a pink face, Ken.
Well, I'm colorblind, Zach, so come on, man. Give me some space.
If I don't point that out, someone will point it out for us, so I just feel the need.
Was it pink? Okay. Maybe it's me. Maybe it was my TV. Maybe
it's my TV. Black and white TV, Ken.
Well, in this, yeah. All right, wise guy. You know, that's what I was watching in the 70s, I hate to admit. But the TV that the kids used to have to watch was black and white because my dad had the color TV for the ball game.
And it
was square. It was square. And I also not only doubled as both his son and his remote. So it worked out really well for the family. Yep, get up and change the channel. And I did. So at any rate, I
love the Mugatu. I'm surprised that you're not a fan of it. I love the Mugatu. I just find it a very creative design because I mean, how many times in Star Trek like you got to give the original series credit because they went all out with these crazy designs, right? Even when they miss.
I don't hate the Mugatu. I think you know, like I said, it's Star Trek iconic. I laugh at it. That's what I do because it is just so outrageous. And you know, when you think of 60s and you think of maybe doing a little bit too much LDS, right? When they put this thing together. That somebody just came up with, and we'll just do this, and we'll put this on it. And you look at this thing, and you just go, what the F were they thinking? And you love it. You love it.
Yeah, that's, we got to. And if you're not familiar with it out there, listeners, it was actually originally called the Gumatu, I believe, but DeForest Kelly kept messing it up, and everyone kept messing it up, so they just changed it to Mugatu, because they could not pronounce Gumatu. And in the script, I believe they just said, you know what, guys, we're calling it Mugatu from here on out. So that's a funny point of trivia there. But you know, I also, you know, for the Mugatu here, it's not the focus of the episode. All these other creatures have kind of been the crux of each episode. Like, oh, the man trap, you know, we got to stop this creature, or Devil in the Dark, we got to stop this creature, or you know, the Gorn is Kirk's main adversary in Arena. But here, it just kind of there. It exists on that planet. It causes some drama because it obviously bites Kirk, and he has to get healed. And and all that stuff, but it's not, they're not there like to fight the Mugatu. It's just a wildlife on this planet, and they have something completely unrelated to that creature going on. It's just an obstacle in their path, and I like that, because you would come across these things, you know, going from planet to planet. So it added just some richness to the tapestry of Star Trek. Because whenever they go to these planets, they beam down, there's nothing else there, right? I mean, there's like some plants, some rocks. It's Vasquez rocks, Zach, most of the time.
Zach, you just said it enriches the tapestry. Mugatu enriches the tapestry of the planet. Maybe you need drug testing, brother. I don't know, man. Does it enrich the tapestry? I don't know if the Mugatu does that, but, you know, I don't know. All right, I'll tell you what. You know, I have never, ever, ever, you know, worn a costume or cosplayed or anything like that. Now the challenge, the gauntlet has been out there. We're going to have to put together a Mugatu costume.
Mugatu costume.
We got to.
Well said, Ken. Well done. So our next creature would be, and again, the Gorn's not a monster or creature. It's an alien, right? But it's just the way it's presented. It's not just another guy with a beard or a guy with a thing on his head, right? It's an actual true alien monster, if you will. Now, the Tholians, what would you think about them?
You know what? I don't count those guys. They're Vulcans to me, or, you know, I shouldn't say that way, but they're, you know, well, they're Andorians. They're whatever. You
right.
Know, they're
Tellarites. Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah, something more along those lines. I mean, they're not quite Gorn. And I guess you could say Gorn are similar, right? Because they're space traveling aliens. But now, my opinion, I never thought of them as a scary monster. I looked at them as some kind of weird adversary. And, you know, in the original series, watching them, and I really like the Tholian web, they were animated. So it was kind of hard to...
Yeah, there's only on a view screen, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they had a very distinct look. It wasn't until Enterprise, where they really show the Tholian.
See,
right?
But I don't like the Tholian. In Enterprise...
It didn't work. It just didn't
because
work.
Because I had this book called Worlds of the Federation when I was a kid. And some of you out there might know what I'm talking about. And it had all these like sketches of aliens, like to scale. And you see different perspectives of drawings of each alien. You use Klingons, humans, Andorians, Tholians. And obviously the only point of reference, because this book is like from the late 80s or early 90s, is the Tholian web. And what they do is they just show the Tholians as crystals, like floating crystals. And you kind of just assume they have some kind of telekinesis technology. And I thought that was very interesting. And so that's how I always thought of the Tholians, because we never see their full body. Of course, on the view screen, we just see, you know, the head or face, whatever it may be, of the Tholian that talks to Spock. So when you see an Enterprise and it's like a crab with like legs, I'm like, this is not right. This just seems very, I don't know. I know that's not canon, right? Because it's in a book, and whenever it's not on screen, it's not established. You can do whatever you want. But that just, it didn't sit right to me to have this like crab leg crawling around Tholian. It didn't seem as dignified as like a floating crystal.
Yeah, yeah. That's a different view because I didn't have that book or I had never seen it. But I see where you're going. It was for me. It was just they were very mysterious and whatnot. And though I think there was a, you know, they had to do something to kind of tie in the Tholians. Obviously, they had the Defiant captured and all of that stuff. But it just, yeah, they just couldn't pull it off. And sometimes, you know, when you try to take something like that and sexy it up or whatnot with computer enhancement or whatnot, it's tough to meet everybody's expectations. Hey, they gave it a heck of a run, but it just didn't work.
Well, I think in the 2000s, television thought like, oh, we have CGI now, we can do anything. Like back in, I mean, there's a reason why Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and, you know, even Voyager were like, okay, these are iconic creatures, but we're not going to try and update them for modern Trek because it just, we're going to lose something in the translation. And then we got to, you know, the mid 2000s with Enterprise, like, oh, we can do a Tholian and a Gorn now, check it out, guys. And of course, you know, a Star Trek fan is like, oh, wait, we haven't seen that thing in 40 years. I bring it on. And you see it, you're like, oh, now I see why you haven't seen it in 40 years. Like, you cannot recapture the magic. And I think that's, and you know, all credit, look, they tried. I'm not saying they half-assed it by any means, but there's just something about there's a reason the old ones are iconic and the new ones just don't live up to the hype. So
That's right. Hey, yeah, you know, like I said, they tried. And for us, right, we we hope they succeed because we love the fan service element of it. We love it when they pull something from another series and pull it in. I mean, that it, because it ties everything together, right? And they gave it a good shot. Just fell a little short.
And then finally, the last creature, if you will, on the original series would be Yarnek from the Savage Curtain. He's an Excalibian, a rock monster. He's very similar to the Horda, where he's just a pile of rocks that kind of comes alive. And he clicking his hands incessantly throughout the episode. I thought he was a very interesting design. Again, he's an alien race, so they're not like a monster creature. But I guess in this conversation, my thoughts on him were just any kind of non-humanoid entity that the crew encounters kind of counts. Because you don't see this kind of stuff, really, in the 80s and 90s Star Trek. They get away from it. And they, the 60s was a magical time where you could... You could try stuff and get away with it more so than you could like in the 80s and the 90s, I feel. So that's why Star Trek, sometimes it's and I've messed up this phrase before on this podcast, and I'm about to do it again, but what is the phrase, Ken? Help me out here.
You're asking me to help with wording. That's
the
great.
Grasp.
That's great. Yeah, it's reach, just outside the grasp.
Something
yeah, I
like
think so.
Everyone,
I think
if you've seen The Prestige, they talk about it in that movie. You guys know what I'm talking about. Anyway, The Reach did
yeah,
not...
Yeah, that's a good movie.
That's a
yeah.
brilliant movie. But they yeah, say was. That. It's like, man's grasp exceeds his reach or vice versa. You guys know what we're saying. So, in the original series, they weren't afraid to do that, right? And that's why we got cool stuff like Yarnek.
I thought he was pretty clever. I had a great voice. A similar voice we've heard many times on the episode. But I like how he kind of materialized, became all steamy, and, I was like, okay, he's pretty threatening. And powerful creature. I liked the clicking of the claws. I thought that added, I don't know why, but I thought that just added a little bit more villainy to it, even though he wasn't really a villain. The race was trying to figure out what the difference between good or evil. So if you hear two words, good, evil, and you don't have any idea what they mean or... is evil what is good? Is good what is evil? That type of thing. Trying to figure that out. I thought that these the design of it was very clever, and when you saw what in the deleted scenes or in the test scenes from Star Trek V, it really was pretty close, right? When that rock monster that they tried to build, steaming too, if I remember right, and it was kind of close to that. I thought, anyway. So I know it didn't work out, but it's one of those creatures that I thought, Star Trek, very alien, very unique. And, an episode two I really enjoyed right up until the end, and then I just didn't like the ending. But I thought it was a good episode for the most part.
You mentioned the voice of Yarnek. That's actually Bart LaRue, who had done three other voices on the original series, Ken. Can you guess who they are?
No, not off the top of my head. I know I've heard them many times. His voice is very distinct.
So he did one of the providers in the game Scissors of Triskelion, one of the brains. He was the voice of Trelane's father and Squire of Gothos.
Ah, okay.
And probably most famously, he was the voice of the Guardian of Forever in City on the Edge of Forever. So.
Yeah, I thought he had a great voice, very distinctive, and it had a kind of an electronic feel to it when he was an Excalibian.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, those are all the creature, monster, non-humanoid entities that the crew encountered. As far as big, obviously there was like clouds and stuff like that, and sometimes little puppets. We're not going to count every last little thing, but somebody in a suit interacting with the crew is what we're looking at, the monsters, the creatures of the original series. Now, looking at the movies, really not much in the way of that. I mean, there was a shapeshifter, Marcy in Star Trek VI, but again, that's not like a monster creature. They weren't really concerned with that kind of stuff in the original series movies. Now you get to the Kelvin timeline. The real ones that we identified were the monsters on Delta Vega.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They had the werewolf type thing, running after him, and then of course he gets eaten by kind of like a rendition of Cloverfield, yeah. Only an ice monster Cloverfield, right? I guess.
Yeah, like a bad robot creature number 17 or whatever, right? Just you can tell it's off that assembly line of monsters, right?
it definitely was, and you know, played off that same thing as it did in Phantom Menace, as you were mentioning off mic earlier. It's, you know, up there's, you know, not the bigger fish, but the bigger creature that comes out of nowhere,
right?
And just adds to the I guess to the drama, so to speak. And of course, you know, nothing that a huge creature that has the ability, I guess, to swallow you whole, but doesn't like a stick of fire at all. So. Go
yeah.
Get him, Spock.
Yeah, that was contrived, to say the least. But, you know, if the original series had the budget of today, I'm sure things like the Mugatu would be some, you know, monster, you know, like that. Just obstacles they encounter, they probably run into more of those things. So I keep going back to the Mugatu. Maybe that should be our t-shirt. Instead, Kent.
Maybe. You know, it just... Okay, we're back on the Mugatu. It's poisonous. So it is everything. It's a dinosaur. It's a unicorn. It's a gorilla, right? And it's poisonous. That's incredible.
It's the perfect entity. It's the alien xenomorph of its time.
It's furry, you know? So it's always, you know, it can be comfortably warm.
Oh, man.
It's unbelievable. I guess it can climb trees, too. Why not? It's a gorilla. It's amazing. Yeah, it really is.
I want to see a Mugatu in Star Trek IV, I swear. And they can do it. Look, I feel like you could have, like, I didn't realize this was going to be a Mugatu conversation tonight, but you could totally update the Mugatu probably easier than any of these other creatures, right? Because it's a guy in an ape suit, and, you know, we've seen, you know, some impressive ape suits. I mean, look at even 2001 A Space Odyssey, right? Those are some excellent-looking ape suits back then. So even today, when it's not done for comedy, you know, they actually take it seriously. You can get a good-looking guy and You can get a good-looking...
What are you talking about?
You can get a good-looking ape
Brad
suit.
Brad Pitt is going to play the Mugatu?
Genius casting. It's like Ed Norton in Kingdom of Heaven, right? He's under that mask the whole time. You don't even see him, but it's Ed Norton. So there you go. I want to see Brad Pitt as the Mugatu in Star Trek IV. He can fight George Kirk. George Kirk can get bit by the Mugatu.
Oh, my God.
There's really nothing else to talk about. We've clearly... wrap back around plenty of times now. If we forgot anything, please let us know. I'm sure you guys will, and I'm sure we did, because, you know, we're not perfect, guys. We're not the Mugatu, so.
No, we are not the Mugatu. That's your t-shirt right there. We are not the Mugatu. We are not some kind of seriously gone wrong splicing accident.
Well, the monsters and creatures of Star Trek aren't the only thing we're discussing this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at some other things you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
That's not to take away anything that they are. They have the same standard of excellence. They are as brilliant, as smart. They're good leaders. But they're guys who go home. They're guys who drink. They're guys who go to the bar. They're guys who get in fistfights. They're, you know, guys who have wives and argue, and they're guys who deal with loss.
To the journey!
I've just got this vision now of Janeway there. Who's a good Voyager? Who's a good girl?
Well, she liked to, you know, stroke the halls and everything.
So Tom Paris would be like, who's a good girl? You want to go for a ride? Let's go.
Literary Treks.
I'm glad we reread this, because at the time I did read this, it was when the new movie was out. But now that we've had the three movies, as you just mentioned, and I've seen Star Trek 09 about 100 times, I'm very familiar with the movie, and not as much as with the comic now, because I've only read it maybe a couple of times.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes and helps us increase our visibility for new listeners.
If you would like to get in touch with us here at trek.fm, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter @trekfm, facebook.com/trekfm, and the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Shrek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
So let me talk to you for a second about Patreon, Zach. Patreon is the program that Trek FM employs in order to get donations to keep the network coming to you commercial free. It is wonderful. Most of the hosts here on Trek FM are big contributors to Patreon and found our way onto the network through Patreon. So if you can spare any money, and we don't care what the denomination is, it really means a lot to us because there is a lot of content that we're putting up there, a lot of bandwidth, a lot of programming, a lot of equipment that we need. So please, if you can help us out, we'd appreciate it. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and you can click any donation you want. And we do have some incentives for you. So for $15 a month, you get to join the Patrons Roundtable, where you podcast. And you know, again, that is where a lot of us started. It was on the Roundtable. I was on the very first one. I had a blast. And if you can contribute $25 or more per month, then you get associate producer credits for whatever show you like. And we love our associate producers. So please, 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 if you have the ability, it is more than appreciated. And speaking of our associate producers, thank you from the bottom of our hearts to Renee Roberts, Aaron Harvey, Nicholas Anastasio, and of course, Norman Lau. Thank you all for your support of Standard Orbit and Trek FM through Patreon. Now you can find Renee at Twitter at @Emrys_1701. You can find our buddy Aaron Harvey at GeekFilter. You can find Norman Lau at Starfighter1701, and you can interact with Nick and all of us on the Babel Conference, and that's where we find Nick hanging out all the time. Yeah, and you can find me on the Babel Conference. I love to hang out there, and you can reach me through Facebook directly or via Twitter. My handle is @BostonSCPO. That stands for Senior Chief Petty Officer.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter @MoronZach. That's MoreOnZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show from the early 2000s. And we're on Twitter @AlwaysMallville with one S. And also, I'm around the Babel Conference as well. It's always great to talk to you guys on there, making conversation about our shows, other shows, general Star Trek topics, anything really on there. So thanks for listening, everyone. And join us again next time here on Trek.fm for another episode of Standard Orbit.